When I was about 15, I came across a fascinating book, at least it was for me. It was actually a reference book, but it was a reference book unlike any other that I'd seen to that time. The book was called The Guinness Book of World Records. I suspect most of you are familiar with that book. I found this a truly fascinating book when I was young, because it told of things or people that were the fastest at something or the tallest or the longest or whatever it happened to be. This book has probably fallen out of favor compared to when I first discovered it, but the organization Guinness World Records still operates and people still seek to be in it. You know, they can call ahead, they can have a representative record whatever it is, record they're trying to break, and they will be put in the book. I'll give you one example that I found very fascinating here. This was, I think, not quite a year ago when I came across this individual, and he actually ended up in the Guinness Book of World Records because of this. His name is Eric Brown. Interesting thing about Mr. Brown is that he's probably about 96 now, almost, and he holds a number of couple of records for aviation, one of which is that he is the individual that has flown the most aircraft, meaning different types of aircraft. And to show you what kind of record we're talking about, he has flown 487 different types of airplanes, more than any other person. He also holds the record for the most aircraft carrier landings. And most every pilot that's in the military says that those are the most difficult. But he has landed on an aircraft carrier 2,407 times in his career. And consequently, he has the British Fleet Air Arm's most decorated pilot status, as you can imagine. I think one of the reasons why the Guinness World Record book has waned in popularity is because they began to include records for just about everything. It wasn't just the major things that people would think about. They even divided categories into subcategories until, in many ways, the special became very common. For instance, if I were to ask you to tell me who the strongest man is, what would be your answer? Well, we have to define strongest, don't we? Is that strength muscular, or is it strength endurance? Am I talking about active strength, passive strength? And I'll give you an example you might have seen in the news here recently. There was a man that set the world record for the longest plank. Most of you know what a plank is, I think. It's almost like a push-up, but you're not pushing up. You're on your forearms, your body is straight, and your toes are in a position like a push-up. He held that for over 5 hours. I can't imagine. It makes my stomach hurt just thinking about it. But that's one of the examples. So let me re-ask the question in a very specific way. Who is the strongest man? I'm talking about muscular strength. Who is the strongest man recorded in Scripture? I think almost everyone would say Samson. Today we're going to take a look at Samson's life. This is a very interesting life. I'm going to make it very easy on you today. We only have two scriptures that are not in the book of Judges. So we'll start in Judges 13. You can begin turning there. I find the story of Samson very interesting because it goes back to my childhood. When I was very young, my mother would read to my younger brother and I from, I think many of you have these sets, the Bible story books that Worldwide Church of God put out years ago, and then I think United even republished them at one point. But I was fascinated by these stories, and when she would come to the section about Samson, I just loved it. You know, the incredible strength. You know, what little boy can't have a vivid imagination about some of the feats of strength that he's doing there, and the determination that he had in the face of these obstacles, and what amazingly bad decisions he made at times. It's all there. It's the story of Samson's life. Now, the time period is about 1000 BC, during the period of what is called the Judges of Israel. And as we pick up the story in Judges 13, we find that his parents, before they had him, were childless. But an angel came and gave them instruction from God that they certainly were going to have children, and there was a special responsibility their son would have. So Judges 13 in verse 2, it says, "There was a certain man from Zorah of the family of the Danites whose name was Manoah, and his wife was barren and had no children." Now, as it says in verse 41, the Philistines had been afflicting the children of Israel for 40 years. Israel had a history during this period of obeying God and being blessed, prospering, and then as they would wane in that obedience and turn away from God, God would send oppression, whether it was the Midianites, whether it was the Philistines or someone else, and they would go through these periods of oppression, and then they would repent and God would restore them, and they repeated this cycle for hundreds of years. And so this is during part of that time. Verse 3, the angel that God sent said to the woman, "Indeed now you are barren and have borne no children, but you shall conceive and bear a son." And as I said, the son was to have a special responsibility, and we find that in verse 4. "Now therefore," he's telling the parents, "please be careful not to drink wine or similar drink, and not eat anything unclean." Now, they were to instruct the son in this as well. It wasn't just for the parents. This was the life that he was to have. They were told not to cut Samson's hair. They were told to pass on this information about not drinking wine or eating grapes, and that he was to not become defiled. That's the aspect of anything unclean. It's not just food. It had to do with other things as well. But in verse 5, we see this. It's, "For behold, you shall conceive and bear a son, and no razor shall come upon his head." That was part of the Nazarite vow. This was a sign that they were set apart. He said, verse 5, "No razor come upon his head, for the child shall be a Nazarite to God from the womb." Normally, the Nazarite vow could be temporary. It could be a couple of weeks. It could be a couple of months. The time period was not specified. In this case, God specified that it was to be for his whole life. "And he shall begin to deliver Israel out of the hand of the Philistines." This was the responsibility that God had in mind for Samson. Now, Samson's special abilities were not in his hair, or because he didn't eat grapes or drink wine. He was special because God gave Samson his spirit. We'll see that here in a little bit. But God did give him a very unique job. And as we read here at the end of verse 5, it was to begin to deliver Israel out of the hand of the Philistines. So how is he going to do this? Well, the rest of chapter 13 is this angel interacting with the parents. And at first he appeared to the wife, and she told her husband, and he believed her, but he wanted to see for himself. He wanted to hear for himself. So they prayed the angel would come back, and he gave them various instruction. And then they made an offering to God, and the angel went up in the fire. And so then verse 14, to pick up the story, in verse 1, Samson, we find now, is a young man. We're not told specifically what age, but he's old enough now to begin to fulfill the responsibility that God has given to him. But Samson's focus is not right. And so in verse 1, it says, "Samson went down to Timnah, saw a woman in Timnah of the daughter of the Philistines. So he went up and he told his father and his mother, saying, 'I've seen a woman in Timnah of the daughters of the Philistines. Now, therefore, get her for me as wife.'" And in the culture of the time, this was not unusual. He's not demanding something necessarily. It was the families who made the arrangements for the marriage. And so then verse 3, the parents are concerned here because this is a Philistine, not a member of Israel. And they say this to him in verse 3, His father and his mother said to him, "Is there no woman among the daughters of your brethren or among all my people that you must go and get a wife from the uncircumcised Philistines?" And Samson said to his father, "Get her for me, for she pleases me well." It's a very interesting thought, because in verse 1, it said he saw her. So what's he basing the relationship on? What he sees. A very shallow relationship. We'll see here in a little bit. But rightly so, the parents are concerned here because he's basing this all on the wrong thing. The instruction in marriage is to become one, not just one flesh, but one mind, operating together, having the same desires and goals, the same purpose in life. The parents see this and they're concerned about this. The reason why God gave Israel instruction not to marry the other nations was not because he was xenophobic. He did not hate these other nations. But he knew, because they didn't worship him, that the likelihood was very high that they would draw away Israel from worshiping him, which they proved time and time again. And so in verse 14, it says, "His father and mother did not know that it was of the Lord." God was allowing this, not that God was directing him to do this. God was allowing this, because remember what we read earlier. Ultimately, Samson's responsibility that God was giving him was to break the power of the Philistines. So God allows this. And it says that he, meaning God, was seeking an occasion to move against the Philistines, for at that time the Philistines had dominion over Israel. Now, God used Samson's desire, again, to be clear here, not that this is what God desired for Samson. So God can even use in our lives things that we do wrong. I had this conversation with someone the other day. Even when we make bad decisions, God can still bring it to good. He doesn't desire the bad decision, but it just shows how powerful God is, but also how much he cares for us and how he can work these things out. So in verse 5, to continue the thought, Samson went down to Timnah with his father and his mother. This is the wedding feast. Some commentaries say this was the conversation to arrange the marriage. But nonetheless, they're going down to Timnah, and it says they came to the vineyards of Timnah, and to his surprise, a young lion came roaring against him. Now verse 6 tells us that his parents were not with him. But Samson is surprised by this lion. And it says in verse 6, the spirit of the Eternal came mightily upon him, and he tore the lion apart as one would have torn apart a young goat, as though it was nothing in his hand. And to me, that's phenomenal. I don't even know how you tear a goat. And here, Samson is tearing apart this lion, and it says with his bare hands. He didn't have any weapon. And although it says young lion, it doesn't mean that it was a small lion. It simply means that it was a juvenile, but many juvenile lions are larger than even mature female lions. And if it's going to surprise him, as it says in verse 5, it has power. It's got the element of surprise. Its intent is to kill this creature, whatever it is, in this case Samson, and have it for dinner. But it says at the end of verse 6, but he did not tell his father or mother what he had done. And we're not told why. Many of these stories that we read, especially in Judges here, oftentimes we're given the high points. And there are so many more details that I would like to know. And this is one of them. Why did he not tell his parents? I don't know. But it ends up being part of an additional story here. As we read before we leave this in verse 6, again, to reiterate the point, Samson's strength came from God. Now, certainly, it manifested in his body. I can only imagine how solid he was with the strength that he had and the way he would carry himself and so forth. But so then to pick up the story in verse 7, it says, he went down and talked with a woman, and she pleased Samson well. And so then in verse 8, we come to them returning for the marriage ceremony. So the wedding date had been set. Samson is going to stop, as we see, on his way down, and he's curious. This lion that he killed, he wants to go check it out. And again, we're not told why. Why did he want to go see it? Maybe to see what had happened to it. Maybe just to see what it looked like as a carcass, you know, with maybe some of the flesh or all of it stripped off. But in verse 8, it says, as he turned aside on his way down there, he looked at the carcass of the lion, and a swarm of bees had set up in it. They'd created a hive inside the carcass, and they'd created all of this honey. And so verse 9, he took some of it in his hands. Probably not just the honey, probably a chunk of the honeycomb that he could eat along the way, because there are even properties in the honeycomb itself that are very beneficial. And it becomes a movable snack. And it says he even took some and gave them to his parents, and they ate it. But he did not tell them that he had taken the honey out of the carcass of the lion. Now maybe God inspired this in part for what's going to follow here. But nonetheless, this whole event is not a secret. That's probably too strong a word. It's just something he kept in confidence to himself. But perhaps God was going to use this, as we see here in a moment. Because what he decided to do is to use this event as a riddle. Samson was not an unintelligent man. He's noted for his strength. But at times he was very crafty in the right way. Very cunning. And perhaps maybe to, in a nonviolent way, put the Philistines down a notch or two, he approaches them with this riddle. And so in verse 12, he says, let me pose a riddle to you. If you can correctly solve and explain it to me within the 7 days of the feast, then I will give you 30 linen garments and 30 changes of clothes. And so they're probably thinking, we've got a group of guys here, we can figure this out. You know, that's easy peasy. You know, we can get new clothes out of the whole deal. And it says in verse 13, so they said, pose the riddle. So they agreed to the terms, because what he said was, if you can't answer it, then you owe me 30 garments. If you answer it, then I owe you 30. So they said, okay, you got a bet. And so verse 14 tells the riddle. Out of the eater came something to eat. Out of the strong came something sweet. Now, we know that it's a lion, and we know that it's honey, because we've already read that part of the story. But if you don't know that it's a lion and you don't know that it's honey, what would you think of this? They didn't know either. And so for the next 7 days, 3 days it says there at the end of the verse, for 3 days they could not explain it. And it came to pass on the seventh day they said to Samson's wife. So they're up against the deadline. They're not going to be on the hook for these clothes. And they decide that they're going to meddle here. And so they strong arm, if you will, Samson's wife. Entice your husband, verse 15, that he may explain the riddle to us. Notice the mindset here. This is what God is breaking. He says, or else, they say, or else we will burn you and your father's house with fire. Have you invited us in order to take advantage of what is ours? She's innocent in many ways in this. They're the ones that made the bet. They're the ones that agreed to this. And yet, because they're on the hook now, they're going to take it out on someone else. So, verse 17, she wept on him the 7 days while the feast lasted. And it happened on the seventh day that he told her, because she pressed him so much. Doesn't say much for their relationship, does it? Now, maybe, just maybe though, Samson thought that he could entrust her with this confidence, not expecting that she would betray him, but that's exactly what she did. Because initially he says, at the end of verse 16, look, I've not explained it even to my parents. Why should I explain it to you? Now, perhaps he should have. She's his wife, after all. But nonetheless, she pressed the matter, and so he tells her in verse 17, because she pressed so much. And so then she goes and explains the riddle to the men. So then in verse 18, they come on the deadline on the seventh day before the sun went down, and here's their answer. They say, what is sweeter than honey? What is stronger than a lion? And he knew as soon as they said that where they got their information, because he made this up. So no one would have known. So he says to them, if you had not plowed with my heifer, you would not have solved my riddle. Now, in our 21st century American mindset, that sounds like a very harsh thing to say, isn't it? He's calling her a cow. But he's not calling her a cow. Because in that day and age, the way you plowed was to put oxen or cattle together under yoke. So what he's saying here is, you got this answer by going to my helpmate, the one I'm yoked with. And that made him very, very angry. And so in verse 19, it says, the spirit of the Eternal came upon him mightily, and he went down to Ashkelon, and he killed 30 of their men. Now, he didn't tell them how he was going to get the 30 changes of clothing if he lost the bet, did he? It still came out of their own people. He went down to Ashkelon, he killed 30 men in their, took their apparel, gave the changes of clothes to those who had explained the riddle. And so his anger was aroused, and he went back up to his father's house. He was so angry at what had taken place, and probably very angry at his wife, that he left her at her father's house. He went back to his parents' house because of his anger. Now again, this shows the strength of Samson. How do you kill 30 men? He probably did it with his bare hands, and he probably had to do it in such a way that he didn't ruin the clothes, because they would have noticed. So in the meantime, Samson leaves, and notice in verse 20, his wife was given to his companion who had been his best man, unbeknownst to Samson. He thinks this woman is still his wife, because in chapter 15 he goes back and she's no longer his wife. But before we get to that, let's cover a few more things. Probably the only good thing at this point that's come out of this chain of events was that God, through Samson, was beginning to weaken the Philistine nation. Now, it might not seem that 30 individuals would be much of an auspicious start, but they were not just interested in clothes, because they made this bet, if you will, at a wedding feast, which would have been the best of their garments, which in our vernacular means their expensive clothes. They're the best that they have. And so to get those kind of clothes, he's beginning to, if you will, kill the leadership. That's what I take from this. So then, chapter 15, after spending some time with his parents and this anger that he had, and it subsides eventually, he decides, Samson, to go back to Timnah for his wife. But as was mentioned, as he went there and asked, inquired for her, he found that she had been given to someone else. So verse 1, after a while, the time of the wheat harvest, it happened that Samson visited his wife with a young goat. He went with a present. Maybe he went with hat in hand to apologize to her. Again, we're not told. But he went down, he was going to try to make good, and he said to the father-in-law, let me go into my wife, into her room. But the father would not permit him to go in, and he said, I really thought that you thoroughly hated her. Therefore, I gave her to your companion. Is not her younger sister better than she? Look, I've got another daughter. Why not just marry her and be happy? That wasn't what Samson wanted. So in verse 3, he says, this time I shall be blameless regarding the Philistines if I harm them. Like there was really much doubt, from the way I read this, there's really not much doubt he was going to harm them. So then verse 4, he went and he caught 300 foxes. So before we read over that, let me just ask the question. How do you catch 300 foxes? And what do you do with them after you catch them? How do you keep them until you've got all 300? Did he figure at the beginning he needed 300? Or did he just go out and got on a roll and at the end of it he had 300? I don't know. But nonetheless, he did this. I mean, how fast do you need to be? Did he do it with traps? Did he catch them with his bare hands? When I gave this morning, I related a story Mr. Stiver at Challenger Camp told about a fellow that was in one of his church areas years ago. And before he came into the church, he liked to eat rabbit. And so in order to catch rabbit, he found the best way to do this was not to trap them, not to shoot them, but to catch them. And he would catch rabbits. Now, how do you catch a rabbit? Same question with a fox. Rabbits are not slow in creatures, right? They're pretty quick. So they asked him one time, and I forget his name, but they said, you know, how do you catch these rabbits? And he says, well, I catch them where they're going, not where they are. What he meant by that was he anticipated their moves. And he got close enough, he would look at them sideways. Rabbits are not extremely intelligent. If they don't think you're a threat, they don't flee right away. So he'd kind of saddle up to them sideways. And when they finally bolted, he was paying enough of attention out of the side of his eye that he would leap to where they were going, not where they were, and he would catch them. Well, maybe you do that with foxes. I don't know. But notice this. Then after he has these foxes, it says he took torches and he turned the foxes tail to tail, end to end, back end to back end. And then he tied this torch between each of their tails. Now, first of all, then how does he do this? Now, he's caught the foxes. They can't be happy about this, right? They don't want to be there trying to get away. How do you tie them tail to tail? Did he tie their tails together? Or did he have some sort of rope, cording that he would tie? And then he tied this firebrand between it. So it says, then he set the torches on fire. So maybe this was a brand that had been in the fire, a piece of wood that he could tie to it. Maybe it was a piece of tinder that he could light with something. But then he sets these torches on fire and he let the foxes go into the standing grain. Now remember in verse 1, it was the time of the harvest. So this grain is dry. It's ready to be harvested. And it wasn't just the grain. It wasn't just the wheat, notice. It says that it burned up both the shocks and the standing grain. So what they had cut and put into bundles, ready to put into whatever storage or to mill into the grain they were going to have right away. But notice also the vineyards and the olive groves. So you can only imagine 150 pair of foxes. And they're probably trying to get away from each other. So they're bouncing all over the place. And they're just lighting everything on fire. I can only imagine what the sky looked like when this took place and the destruction that took place, because this is their income. It's the end of the growing season, everything that they had worked for, and it's just all going up in flames. And the trees, the olive groves, the vineyards, now you're not just talking this year's harvest, they're dead. You've got to start over now. So you can imagine verse 6, Philistines are extremely angry. Who has done this? And the answer came back, Samson, the son-in-law of the Timnite. So Samson's not there, so they go after the family. It says, because he has taken his wife and given her to his companion, he was angry, they said. Now, did they get mad at Samson? I think indirectly. But notice, they filled their pledge of what to do to the wife if they were not happy. It says they burned her and her father with fire. You can see why God was removing the Philistines. They were horrible in the way they acted, the way they treated, and the way they thought. And so then verse 7, Samson says, "Since you would do a thing like this, I surely will take revenge on you, and after that I will cease." Samson tended to look at these things from a personal perspective. To a large degree, understandably so. I mean, even though his father-in-law had given his wife away to someone else, I suspect that there was still an attachment there. He liked this woman on some level. I wouldn't want to see anybody die that way. And his anger is aroused again, and he's forgetting who's the one that has the right to vengeance. This is his vengeance. And so in verse 8 it says he attacked them hip and thigh. And I find that a very curious expression. I couldn't find a good answer as to what that means, except that most commentaries seem to agree that it means a ruthless slaughter. Alicia said her Bible said that it was a wrestling term, maybe the way you move to take down an opponent. But it doesn't say directly that he killed them, but he smote them mightily. It says with great slaughter. Again, we're not told how many. So then he leaves that area and he goes down and dwells in the area of Edom. And it seems that he went to this area just to see what the Philistines would do next. He had provoked them with the foxes and burning all of their crops. They responded by killing his former wife and her father. And so then he goes down and smites these other individuals. And he's waiting to see what their next move is going to be. He wasn't running away. It was just a tactical retreat to see what's going to happen next. So in verse 9, it says, "The Philistines went up, they encamped in Judah, and they deployed themselves against Lehi." So the men of Lehi now are saying, "Well, what did we do? Why are you here?" And so the Philistines answered, "We've come up to arrest Samson, to do to him what he has done to us." So they're out for blood now. And so the men of Judah understand what they're up against. And again, the story skips forward, and it seems that because of verse 11 now, they struck a bargain. Perhaps they said, "Look, if we go get him for you and turn him over to you, will you leave us alone?" Probably something along that line, because in verse 11 it says, 3,000 men of Judah went up. Samson already had a reputation, because you don't normally take 3,000 men to go get one guy. They were worried. Maybe they needed encouragement. That's a lot of encouragement. But they went up to go get him. And when they found him in Edom, they said to him, Do you not know that the Philistines rule over us? Look, we can't control these guys. They're our rulers. They govern us. You know how they are. And all you've done now is poked the bear. What have you done to us? And he simply replies, "As they did to me, I've done to them." Tit for tat. But they said to him, "We have come down to arrest you." They weren't trying to trick him. They weren't being deceptive in that way. And they said that we may deliver you to the hand of the Philistines. And this, again, is why I think Samson's a very intelligent man. He doesn't fight them on this. His battle is not with the men of Judah. As much as you might want to say, "Guys, you're not going to back me up here?" He knows they're in a tough spot. And so they're very upfront with him. So Samson says simply to them, "Swear to me that you will not kill me yourselves." So essentially saying, "Okay, look, I'll go with you voluntarily, peacefully. I'll go with you as long as you tell me, you promise me, you will not kill me, try to kill me." And so they, verse 13, they say that. They said, "No, but we will tie you securely and deliver you into their hand. But we surely will not kill you." So they promised him, "All we're going to do is tie you up, we're going to take you down, we're going to hand you over, and then everything, as far as they're concerned with us, everything's good." So Samson says, "Okay." Now, how do you get delivered into the hand of the enemy so that you can accomplish something further without the initial conflict? And so Samson's playing here with them. And so he goes with them. And when he comes down to Lehi, because remember, this is where they went. They went from Lehi to Edom to go get Samson. So when they come back to Lehi, the Philistines came shouting against him. They were ecstatic. The guy that had created all this problem now, that was beginning to be a huge thorn in their side was being delivered to them. Their troubles were over, but they were only beginning, because it says, "Then the Spirit of the Eternal came mightily upon him, and the ropes that were on his arms became like flax that is burned with fire, and his bonds broke loose from his hands." So if you ever burn dry grass, even if you make sort of a little rope out of it and you light it, it just, it's gone. That's how it was with Samson, that he would have such power that even with ropes on him, it was just a matter of flexing and it's gone. His anger is aroused. He's going to take it out on these Philistines. So in verse 15, then it says, he picks up a fresh jawbone of a donkey. Hadn't died too long ago. So it wasn't brittle. It wasn't a bone that had sat in the sun for years. And it says, he reached out his hand and he took it and he killed 1,000 men with it. Now again, how do you do that? How do you have the energy to kill 1,000 men, let alone with the jawbone of a donkey? And I'm sure they weren't going down easily. Because if you know you're going to have the potential of losing your life, you're going to do everything you can to make that not happen. And whether they had weapons or not, they were probably coming at him in swarms. And yet he killed every one of them. It says 1,000 men. And at verse 18, it says he became very thirsty. Another one of those, I think, understatements of Scripture. Yeah, probably a little. But he allowed them to deliver him so that this would be accomplished. Remember what Samson's responsibility was, that God expected him to begin to break the power of the Philistines. When you start killing individuals in the level of 1,000 at a time, you're going to begin to break that power. But Samson was a little slow on the uptake and learning from his mistakes. He had the anger thing down pretty good. He had the vengeance thing down pretty good. But he wasn't really paying attention to what it was that God wanted him to do. And more importantly, to follow the instruction that God had given in many ways. So in chapter 16, he goes to Gaza. And he sees a harlot there and he went into her. Now, some are at odds as to whether this is Delilah, as she comes into the story later, or whether this was a different individual. It doesn't really matter for the sake of the story. He's still pursuing the wrong women. He has the wrong perspective. And he has the wrong motivation. He's looking at superficial aspects of a relationship. And they're not the right women to be involved with. But when the Gazites, verse 2, were told that Samson had come here, they surrounded the place and they lay in wait for him all night at the gate of the city. They were going to surprise him when he came out. Normally in these cities, they would close the gates at night, not only protect from marauders, but even wild animals. Remember, he was surprised by a lion. This was still very commonplace during this time. Wild beasts. And so they would close the gates and lock them until the morning, and they were going to use that as their opportunity to seize and kill him, as it says at the end of verse 2. So in verse 3, Samson laid low till midnight. Then he arose. They probably weren't guarding the door, thinking that he couldn't do anything about it being locked. But he arose, notice, and he took the gates of the city and the two gateposts, and he pulled them up, bar and all. So he didn't smash them down. He didn't break the locks or break the posts that locked them together. He simply grabbed them and picked both doors up and the sockets with them, the posts that they were hinged to. Just took the whole thing out of the ground. So how much does that weigh? I mean, if you're going to go to the trouble of building a city that has walls thick enough and high enough to protect yourself from armies or from animals, you're not going to make a cheesy door to close everything up. Right? It's going to be as solid as you can make that door. It's going to be reinforced, and it's going to have iron on it to probably bind everything together. The Philistines had iron. I don't know, 1,000 pounds, 2,000 pounds? We're talking a ton if it's 2,000 pounds. But notice, he picked it up, put it on his shoulders, and he carried it to the top of the hill that faces Hebron. Now, we can read over that. But let's not. Let's pause here just a second. We talked about the weight of it. You know, how much could you carry to a top of a hill? Whatever the weight is, how much would it be? You know, if we go out for a hike, we get winded just carrying ourselves up the hill. But here he's carrying these gates, And if you go to a Bible atlas and you look up what he's done here, this is not just, you know, a hill right there and I just go up the hill. Hebron was 43 miles from Gaza. So he's carrying these gates and these posts on his shoulders for 43 miles. Now, it says a hill, but it's not a kettle like around here. It's not just some rolling little thing that's just right there. We're talking a rise of 2,000 feet in elevation. So he's going 43 miles uphill with whatever this weight is on his shoulders. And it was nothing to him. So then the story goes back to his relationships. This is where Delilah comes into the story again, verse 4. It happened that he loved a woman in the valley of Sorek whose name was Delilah. And again, the commentaries are divided as to her background. Some say she was that harlot in verse 1. Some say no, she was just connected to the leadership, those in power and authority. And this is why they came to her. Nonetheless, Samson continues to pursue these wrong relationships. Delilah catches his eye. The Philistines realize this in verse 5, so they come to her and say, entice him, find out where his great strength lies. They know that there's something they're missing, and they want the advantage to be able to take him out of the picture. And they say, by what means we may overpower him, that we may bind him to afflict him, and every one of us will give you, notice, 1,100 pieces of silver. Now, we're not told how many lords there were, just that there were lords. But to give you a bit of a context, when Judas betrayed Christ, it was for how many pieces of silver? 30. Why 30? It's an interesting connection there. If you read in other places in the Old Testament, the price of a slave that was injured, that you had to compensate for, was 30 pieces of silver. So if I owned a slave, a Hebrew slave, and in the course of them doing what I told them to do, they became injured, that they were no longer able to perform the work, I owed them 30 pieces of silver. That was for one person. That was generally the price of a slave. Each one of them here are offering to give her each one of them, 1,100 pieces of silver. This is how serious they took what Samson was doing to the nation. So then Delilah gets into the story here in verse 6. She says to Samson, please tell me where your great strength lies and with what you may be bound to afflict you. Now, I mentioned Samson's intelligence, but when it came to women, he was extremely stupid. As most men are, unfortunately. Because, first of all, why would she be asking this question? Why would he even think there's any innocence behind this question? Yeah, I'm going to tell you what you can do so that I can be taken out of the picture. Samson evidently had his mind in a different place, and it wasn't a good one. Because then he begins to play this game with her. Well, if you do this and that, he says in verse 7, if you bind me with 7 fresh bowstrings. Now, that might seem reasonable because a fresh bowstring has not dried out yet. And typically, bowstring would be made with sinew of an animal. And before it dries out, it's wet, it's fresh. But as it dries out, it shrinks and it gets hard. Well, that would make great binding, wouldn't it? In fact, the binding on an arrow, I learned this at Challenger Camp. The Native American Indians, the binding they would use was deer sinew. And they would cut it into little thin strips. There's no glue. I always thought about that. What do they glue it with? They don't. They take it when it's fresh. They bind the arrow to the shaft. And when it dries, it is not coming off. So, I mean, it seems reasonable, doesn't it? And then the amazing thing is that she does this. And then she yells out to Samson, the Philistines are coming, and he jumps up, and it's like the ropes earlier. It's like they're nothing. They just fall off with his strength. He doesn't think anything of that. She even chides him in verse 10. You've mocked me, told me lies. Please tell me what you may be bound with. And he goes, and he plays the game again. He continues this back and forth. He doesn't seem to understand what she's proposing here. Now, maybe because all of his life, this had never been an issue. He'd never lost his strength. There had been nothing that had ever come up that was unreasonable. I mean, when you can lift a city gate out of the sockets, carry it 43 miles uphill, you're probably not too worried about things not being possible. So then in verse 11, he says, well, if they bind me with new ropes that have never been used, I'll become weak like any other man. So she does this again, and then they fall off, as it says in verse 12, like thread. So she chides him again. You've mocked me and told me lies. And so then he says, if you weave seven locks of my head into the web of a loom. Now, some have speculated that having never cut hair, how would you manage it? Do you just let it go wild? I mean, it would be all over the place, wouldn't it? So some have speculated that he braided his hair in different sections, and then he braided the braids, or he combined the braids into one in the back. So he's essentially saying, well, if you take these various braids and you weave them into a garment on a loom, then he says, then I'll be weak. That almost seems silly to me, but she said, why not? I'll try it. So she did. She does the same thing, calls out to him. He jumps up and destroys the loom, which was not an inexpensive piece of equipment in this day and age. And so then she pulls out the ultimate trump card in verse 15. You don't love me. How can you say you love me when your heart is not with me? You have mocked me these three times and not told me where your strength lies. And then notice, she pestered him daily with her words. She was unrelentless. And he still doesn't understand what she's doing. And rather than leaving, he continues to try to be a part of the situation. He knew from the instruction from his parents that he was to never cut his hair. Now, whether he knew directly, that was part of where he got his strength from. It's not the hair, it was the obedience. Whether that was the case or not, we're not told. But he finally relents in verse 17. So he told her with all of his heart, and he said to her, no razor has ever come upon my head, for I have been a Nazarite to God from my mother's womb. If I am shaven, then my strength will leave me, and I'll become weak and like any other man. And verse 18, she saw that he had told her with all of his heart. So now she knows this is it. So she calls the Philistines officials, and as it says there, verse 19, she lulled him to sleep. She called for a man. Now she must have been really good, because she put him in such a deep sleep that he didn't even feel his head being shaved. I don't know how you do that, but she did. And then after it was cut off, oh, before I leave it there, it says, shaved off the seven locks of his head. And this is what I was referring to earlier, that evidently he had sections, seven sections that he braided the hair into, and then he pulled it together. Seems to be what this is indicating. So then it says she began to torment him. She was calling out like she did before, but she saw that his strength had left him. And so she does this again. She calls out, the Philistines are here. He awoke from his sleep, thinking, I'll go out as I've done before. But he did not know the Lord had departed from him. He'd allowed his hair to be cut. And I would go so far as to say that he had allowed himself to become defiled. Because he was repeating these relationships he should not have been in. And in that regard, he was defiling himself. And so then the Philistines, verse 21, they come in, they take him, and they put out his eyes. Now they have him. He's weak as any other man. It's nothing to overpower him. It says they put him in bronze fetters, basically shackles that they chained him to. And he became a grinder in the prison. He became basically a beast of burden. They probably chained him daily to a bar of a millstone, and he just went round in circles all day long, just grinding their wheat, their corn, whatever it was. Now, at this point, they believe that their god, Dagon, had delivered him. They thought their troubles were over, that once they shaved his head, that it was gone forever. Maybe they believed something else. Maybe they just didn't stop to think about it, because it says in verse 22 that his hair began to grow again. But they wanted to make a mockery of Samson here. He had done great torment to the nation. And so in verse 23, they call him out. They had gathered together, it says here, to offer a great sacrifice to Dagon their god and to rejoice. And so they call him out. Verse 25, their hearts were merry, probably full of drink, alcohol, just even the excitement, the jubilation of now their enemy has been defeated. They said, call for Samson that he may perform for us. He's become a circus monkey. He's a curiosity. His name had probably been so hated and so reviled, mothers had probably said, if you don't behave, Samson's going to come get you. You know, and now here he is. He's reduced to this. So they called for Samson from prison, and he performed for them, and they stationed him between the pillars. Now, typically, architecturally in this time period, especially for a building such as what they're in now, they would have had columns supporting these different levels. And possibly even the roof would have been open in what we would call a courtyard. So you could have people on multiple levels, and he would be in the center where they could all see him. And so they bring him in. Now, before we finish the story here, I want to ask some questions so you can think about some things. How long did this take place? After his capture, it says in verse 22, his hair began to grow before they called him out. How long did his hair need to be before God filled him with strength again? We're not told any of those things. But think of his existence. Now he's a kept man. He's told when to get up, when to go to bed, when he can eat. He's chained to this millstone all day long, doing their work. He's got a lot of time to think, I would suspect. It would probably take, what, a year, two, maybe three for his hair to grow out, depending on how fast it grew and how much God wanted to see an acknowledgement before he gave him strength again. I suspect he had a lot of time to think about the course of his life, the relationships that he'd been a part of. Maybe he thought about the disappointment he gave his parents. They tried to direct him. They taught him. They did their part. He wasn't listening very well. Maybe he thought about how he'd not really appreciated the power, the strength that God had given him, and how oftentimes he simply used it for his vengeance, not for directly doing what God had asked. The end result was the same, but the attitude can make a big difference here. I think he thought long and hard about that. But as it says, his hair was growing out. And so they call him out to make a spectacle of him. Verse 26, he asks the boy that brings him out, because he can't see anything. He's not familiar with this building. He doesn't know where he is. So he simply says, let me feel the pillars which support the temple so I can lean on them. Ostensibly, because he's tired, or he just needs to support himself. It says, the temple was full of men and women. All the lords of the Philistines were there. What was Samson's primary responsibility? Break the power of the Philistines. You can't ask for a better setup than this. It says about 3,000 men and women on the roof watching while Samson performed. So they were probably in a multi-level building. They were probably even on the roof, as it says here, all looking down into this courtyard. So then Samson called to the Lord. This is the only recorded prayer we have of Samson. And he simply says to God, remember me, I pray. Strengthen me, I pray. Just this once. He knew he would die in this. But he was finally to a point where he was going to do what God wanted him to do, even if it meant losing his own life. And notice he says, that I may with one blow take vengeance on the Philistines. And so it says, verse 29, Samson took hold of the two middle pillars. These were probably primary pillars in supporting the structure. And he probably stood between them. It's not that he could pull his arms around them. We'll see here in a moment. Probably that he stood between them and he pushed out. Still, I mean, how do you break pillars so that you compromise the whole structure of the building? I mean, if they're that weak, you're not going to have much of a building to begin with. So, I mean, these are substantial pillars here. But it says he braced himself against them, one on his right, one on his left. And then so Samson says, and this is to God, let me die with the Philistines. And he pushed with all of his might, and the temple fell on the lords and all the people who were in it. And probably the additional weight of all the people was probably compromising the integrity, the weight load, if you will, of the structure itself. And so once he set this in motion, the whole thing probably collapsed very easily. And notice the end of verse 30. It says, so that the dead he killed at his death were more than he had killed in all of his life. And so then his family comes and they take his body away and buries it where his father had been buried. God answered his final prayer. This crippled the nation of the Philistines for some time. All of the leaders were there. I mean, their whole government, their whole leadership of their nation was wiped out in one move. They would have had to start over completely. And there's no doubt that Samson made many, many mistakes. However, he did eventually yield to God's great purpose in his life. We know that because he's listed in Hebrews 11. Doesn't justify the mistakes he made, but it is reassuring to see that even someone can make a lot of mistakes like he made and still come to repentance and still submit their life to God and still be effective in his hands. We can learn from both his mistakes and what he did right. So here are some of his weaknesses. He chose to love women who drew him away from God. Again, God told Israel not to intermarry with these nations because this was his concern. Another point is that he didn't listen to his parents very well. What would have been different in Samson's life if he had listened to their instruction? Don't get involved with these women. I suspect it would be different. We don't know how it would be different, but I have to think that it would be. Would he have had to have done things the hard way? He also forgot the source of his strength for most of his life. If he had considered it, he would have never told Delilah. He would have never played around with it. And as I mentioned, his anger got the best of him repeatedly. He had very little self-control. And then he also used that anger to exact revenge. We know from Romans 12:19 that vengeance is God's, not ours. So what did he do well? Well, as I mentioned, his strength was a gift from God. He understood that. At the end of his life, especially, finally, he understood that. He asked God to fill him with his spirit so he could do this. Just this one thing. We have no evidence recorded, not that he didn't ever, but it's not recorded for us that he had ever done that before. He also finally knew that he was God's servant. And he was willing to sacrifice himself. If it takes my life to fulfill that, then I'm ready to do that. But the thing is that Samson learned these lessons, God's purpose for him. He learned all of this the hard way. We have the fall holy days coming up very quickly on us. And it's through these holy days that we understand God's purpose for mankind. That we understand God's purpose for us. That we see God's faithfulness and the plan of salvation being worked out. And that plan of salvation is that we can be in his family. Are we working with God in regards to his purpose? It's just a question. I'm not condemning. I'm asking the question so we can ponder it. Are we working with God or are we like Samson? You know, when you have that much strength, you don't typically depend on other people. You think you can do it all. Now, Samson did God's will indirectly, but that wasn't the way God intended it. Because along the way, he hurt himself and those around him as well. I can only imagine the pain and anguish that his parents had. Think of the family that was burned. I don't think that they appreciated having to go through that, wanting to do that as well. What would have been different, as I said, if Samson had done God's will the way God wanted it done instead of the way Samson wanted it done? God can work with us even when we make wrong decisions. But why do we have to do things the hard way? We'll never know in Samson's life what would have been different, but we do have his example recorded for us. We know we don't have to repeat those mistakes for us to learn. But God does have a purpose for each of us. And so before we leave this thought, let's look at a couple of verses in closing here. In John chapter 1, this is one of the great questions of life. And there's this alone is a component of God's instruction that most of Christianity, and by extension then the rest of mankind, completely do not understand. Why do we exist? We exist for a reason. We're not time and chance. God's not a disinterested creator. You know, he winds up his creation and then he went off to go do something else. John 1 verse 12, as John began his gospel, he said here, but as many as believe him, speaking of the word, the one we know is the Christ, he says, many as receive him, to them he gave the right, meaning those who follow him, to them he gave the right to become children of God. We don't just pull this out of thin air and talk about being a family of God. This is one verse that shows us. There are many, many others. For many, that's heretical. To think about and to consider and to even teach that we will be God. I mean, if we're children, then we're God, aren't we? I'm a child of my parents, which means I reflect them. So to be children of God means that we're going to reflect Him. Notice also, then, to those who believe in His name, that follow His instruction. That's what this way of life that we're a part of now is to do. It's to show us the way that we become children of God. What needs to be necessary for that? Lastly, let's turn to 1 Thessalonians 2. The story of Samson is a very interesting one. As I said, one that captivated my attention as a young boy. And there are a lot of lessons in all of those stories. We're just using the example of Samson today, just because it's one of my favorite stories. And if I can find Thessalonians here. 1 Thessalonians 2 and in verse 10. Paul writes, "You are witnesses, and God as well, how devout and justly and blamelessly we behaved ourselves among you who believe, as you know how we exhorted and comforted and charged every one of you as a father does his own children, that you walk worthy of God." I have to believe that Samson came to that same place. For him to do what he did at the end of his life and for him to be listed in Hebrews 11, that he finally came to a place that he had to walk worthy of God. Not just about his life, not just about his anger being satisfied. It's not about us, what we want, what we think should happen, or whatever happens to be our pet thing. That the bottom line is, verse 12, that we need to walk worthy of God who calls you into His kingdom and glory. This adds to John 1. Yes, we will be children of God. What this says here is that not only will we be in that family, but we will have His glory. That we will be God. We will not be the Father. We will not be the Son. But we will be in the God family. I think if we really appreciated that and thought about what that means, that would probably change a lot of things in our lives. The bottom line is that we can have eternal life. We have lessons and examples of individuals like Samson, not so that we can feel superior, but so that we can see where they did the right things and where they didn't do the right things, and we can learn from those lessons in our lives as well. So I'll just leave you then with this question, as I asked it earlier. Will we work with God to fulfill His calling, or will we have to learn God's purpose the hard way?